Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Se van acercando las vacaciones y si tienes un bebé en casa, seguro que te preocupa cómo organizar sus comidas durante los viajes, los días de playa o las salidas a la montaña. Una opción cómoda y muy socorrida son los potitos de Nutriben, porque saben cuánto te preocupa dar a tu bebé tarritos nutritivos y con todas las garantías. Los potitos se preparan aquí en España con los mejores ingredientes, como frutas, verduras, carnes o pescados, y solo emplean aceite de oliva virgen extra. Esos ingredientes tal cual se trituran, cocinan y se envasan al vacío para su correcta conservación. Y ya sabes que igual de importantes son los ingredientes que lleva un alimento como los que no lleva. Los potitos de Nutriben son tarritos que no contienen sal, azúcares añadidos, almidón, colorantes, conservantes, gluten o aceite de palma. Recuerda que los únicos potitos son de Nutriben. Gracias a Nutriben y a su marca Potitos por apoyar los buenos contenidos en este podcast.
Hello, I'm Christina Mitre, journalist and author of the Beauty Mail blog. Welcome to my podcast, where every week I will chat with top experts in cosmetics, nutrition, fitness, and wellness to help you feel good and look better. Today, I'm bringing you a guest who is very special to me, because her first podcast, The High Low, inspired this one that you're listening to right now. Dolly Alderton's voice and her stories have covered many kilometers with me, sometimes to the beat of running shoes while training for a race, other times while dragging a suitcase through an airport or walking my dog Pixie through the streets of Lisbon. Dolly is my great travel companion. Whispering in my ear, she moves me from tears to laughter. But above all, she always invites me to reflect, even on my favorite way of eating potatoes. In this interview, I forget that I'm recording a podcast, so please excuse my nervous laugh or my little personal notes. Today's is not an ordinary interview. For this reason, I did not want to edit it, even when we forgot to hit record. Dolly is so natural, open, funny, yes, just as lovely as you would imagine her. And yes, she's that friend that we all want to have. I hope that by listening to us, you feel that you too are part of this conversation about dating and falling in love in the time of Tinder, life with or without children, friendship between women, and how little it is explored in literature, art, and culture. Also about how we handle the passage of time and the regret we feel when we have exposed ourselves so openly on social media. Let me tell you a little secret. The good thing about having a podcast is that suddenly someone you admire gives you an hour of their time, although it was initially only half an hour. And then, voila, conversations like this arise. So how are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit tired at the moment because I'm writing a TV show.
Oh my gosh.
Which is really exciting, but I'm just trying to balance it with everything else. It's getting a bit... it made me realise I will be very bad when I have children because I just can't juggle loads of things. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Are you in Devon, in London? Where are you based now?
I'm in London, in North London.
Okay.
Where are you?
Right now I'm in Spain, but I live in Dubai.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm taking some days off.
How long have you lived in Dubai?
Dubai, I've been there for 2 years already and a pandemic. So probably counts for four.
Yeah, God, yeah.
But I live in London ages, ages ago. So
where did you live?
Well, all over the place. I live in Windsor. I've never been to the castle. I live in Elscore. I lived in Stockwell. I lived in Finchley.
So, wow. Really all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. I was working in PR like in the 2000s. So the latest noughties. So yeah, yeah. Ages ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you. First of all, thank you so much because it's great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you for having me. We're all really excited that I'm doing this. My agency's really excited.
You know, I met your agent at Waterstones ages ago when you launched your first book. And I was telling them, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. And they were like sorting out all the books there. And I was sorting out the books with them. It was so funny.
Oh, when was that? Like 2018?
Yeah. 2 years ago. Yeah. Yeah, I love Waterstones close to Piccadilly. It's my favorite bookshop.
Oh, so. Yeah, I love that one. They're nice in there, those guys.
So, okay, Dolly, I don't want you to steal lots of your time. So,
no worries.
There we go. Dolly, in her interviews, Terry Gross always tells very calmly and in a very restrained way that she's a fan of her interviewee. So I'm going to do the same because Terry knows better. And I'm going to tell you that I'm an enormous, enormous fan of your work. I have to say that I started this own podcast because of the high-low, and your voice has traveled with me from Lisbon to Dubai. And I cry on the back of a very bumpy 4x4 in the Atacama Desert, listening to the audiobook of your memoir, All I Know About Love. So, in fact...
Wow! What an introduction. That's so lovely. That means so much to me because I listen to podcasts a lot, and I live on my own and I travel a lot on my own. So I know how important, truly important podcast voices are for keeping you sane and keeping you company. Same with audiobooks. So I know what it means. It's incredibly meaningful when someone says that about me because I know what those voices have been for me in the past. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I don't want to get emotional, but literally, I remember going through the streets in Lisbon with my dog, listening to you, to your voice. I've listened to all the podcasts, your audiobook. So now that I've said it, I can start with the interview. So, Dolly, welcome to my podcast. Dolly, bienvenida a mi podcast.
Thank you for having me. God, it's so nice to listen to you speak Spanish. I feel like I could just, that could be like a nice little lullaby for me. I want to immediately go straight back to bed and just have you narrate to me in Spanish.
Dolly, your new book, Ghost, is not a memoir, but if we really read between the lines, we find your voice there. You write, when people got into their 30s, they saw every personal decision you made as a direct judgment on their life. Is this something you have experienced?
Yes, I have experienced that. I think I remember reading an interview with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and she articulated it far better, where she said, your 20s are the time where you're working out who you are, and then your 30s are the time where you have to defensively prove to everyone that you made the right decisions about yourself in the previous decade. And I do think that that's true. There's a real sense of doubling down in your 30s because you have marginally less time on earth. You have less biological time if you're a woman. And it feels like your 30s, my friend and I call it the age of envy. And I think one of the reasons is it feels like the decisions that you've made are much more unretractable, even though, of course, we know that's not true and your 30s is still a very young age. And actually, I really do believe that you can kind of start again at any age in your life. But yeah, it definitely does feel that. It feels like in your 30s, your decisions are kind of set in stone, and therefore you have to be very defensive with people about why you made those choices.
Mm. Having a panic attack right now, thinking if your microphone is on, are you recording on your side?
Yeah. Oh, wait, do I need to... What do I need to record on?
Do you have like GarageBand on your computer or
anything? Yes, no, I haven't been recording. I'm sorry.
Don't worry.
Thought you were recording both sides on your Zoom. Thank God you just checked that.
You know, I got so excited talking to you about my memories. I was like, completely forgot about the bloody microphone and the recording.
Don't worry. Do you know what? I'm doing a Sex in the City podcast
at
the moment.
I'm listening to it, so.
Oh, thank you. And the first episode we did. Because I'm used to having a producer who records for me. And so I just thought that Caroline was recording. And then at the end, we recorded for 2.5 hours. And she said, can you send me your recording? And I was like, what recording? And the next day we had to do it all again. Okay, let me record. I'll do a clap.
Don't worry.
There we go. Okay. Now we've got it. So let's get back to the interview. So Dolly, in the book you write, for years we've been told finding love was like an impossible quest of endurance, timing, and luck. But Dolly, now dating is in your pocket. Now we have the dating apps. And what a mess. What has changed?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I wasn't dating for that long before dating apps were launched. I was dating from the age of like, well, I mean, from the age of kind of 17, I suppose, but I mean, you can barely call that dating, whatever I was doing, until 25. I do remember I'd been in London living with friends as an adult for a year before Tinder launched. And I do remember feeling like everything changed overnight. I always say that like that year that Tinder was launched, I think it was 2012, felt like the millennial version of the summer of love. It felt like that was weirdly our sexual revolution. And that was exciting for some, you know, that was kind of exciting because it meant that, as you said, you've got people in your pocket. I found it really difficult to meet people in London. I was like, where is everyone meeting? Where are the clubs? Where are the restaurants? Where are the bars? Where are the like queues where you hear those stories about people meeting? Where are the tubes where people are apparently meeting? So there was something very liberating about, you know, romance or no strings attached sex, just being ready to order. And that was for a young person. I found that, yeah, really exciting. I think I definitely noticed downsides almost immediately. Overnight, I remember people just didn't chat me up anymore. And that was like a great pastime of the messy London night out. It was like the chat up, the drunk person coming over to you, giving you a bad chat up line, or, you know, striking up conversation. And I think I've probably been chatted up since the launch of Tinder. I mean, in the UK, maybe twice, three times in nearly a decade. And I just remember that first year that I was in London, I remember, you know, on every night out, I would end up meeting someone, having a conversation with someone, or snogging someone, or getting a number. But why would you put yourself out on a limb like that if you know that you potentially could embarrass yourself or it could be awkward and you can just go home, order a pizza and sit and chat up a girl through the comfort of your phone and with lots of distance? So, yeah, that's the main differences I think I've noticed in terms of like meeting people.
But there's something that hasn't changed, especially for women. Let me bring what one of the characters says about dating in the book. She says, how much of early days dating was pretending to be unbothered or busy or not that hungry or demonstratively low-key about everything? Dolly, it seems that women can look too intense and are even emotionally paralyzed in relationship by these fears of scaring men off. These are actually descriptions that you have used in the book.
Yeah.
You had a dating column in the Sunday Times. And in fact, now the readers write to you seeking advice in the same paper. Is this something you've seen or you have experienced yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, even now with everything that I know and as wised up as I like to think I am about all the kind of psychological and politicized facets of dating as a heterosexual woman, I still do find myself, you know, making sure that I don't scare a man off, making sure that I take some time to reply to a text, making sure that I'm not being too pushy with the date plans, making sure that I'm not the one suggesting where we meet. And yeah, it's really depressing. It's just emotion and hysteria will just always... Emotion, hysteria, and the biological clock will always be weaponized against women romantically, sadly. And I think that that just is so deeply ingrained in us. The idea that women are emotionally uncontained, that we're, hysterical, intense, deluded, that we don't have proportionate feelings or reactions to things. And the idea that we're, devious baby snatchers the minute that we hit 30, I think that will always be used against us by bad men. And I think it will always be simmering in the unconscious part of our minds by well-intentioned people. Like even women ourselves, I think we probably think that. You know, I remember when my male friends were younger and they would date older women, I would say, be careful. And if I... You know, if my brother talks to me about a girl who's texting him a lot again, I think in my past I had probably said, be careful. So it's just there, sadly. It's still very there.
Yeah. One of the characters even reaches to this conclusion. She says, being a heterosexual woman who loved men meant being a translator for their emotions, a palliative nurse for their pride, and a hostage negotiator for their egos. Wow.
When you read me sentences like that, I understand why every man that I gave a proof of my book to, they were like, it's really angry. I was like, is it? And then I hear that, I'm like, yeah, that bitch is angry.
Yeah, but at the same time, as Lola, one of the characters says, lots of people aren't happy until they're in a relationship. Happiness for them is being in a partnership. So Dolly, do you have like a GPS for love that really works?
No, I wish I did. I wish I did. There's one thing that the last year or so has taught me is, you know, it doesn't matter how much therapy you do. It doesn't matter how many self-help books you read or books about, you know, the psychologies of love or the science of love and sex. It doesn't matter how much you watch your friends make mistakes. It doesn't matter how many times you've made mistakes. None of this matters. If you fall in love, you fall in love. That's it. That's my understanding of it anyway. I'm very susceptible to that. If I meet someone who I feel like I understand and deeply connect with, and I feel like they know who I am and they deeply understand me. If that's the baseline, and then you throw in really great sex, and then you throw in, you know, a sense of wonder together and a sense of adventure together, I mean, I'm completely, you know, humans are completely screwed. It's like it completely throws all of that logic and all of those defense mechanisms out the window. And in a way, I wouldn't have it any other way, as painful as that can be, because that's the reason, that's what sanctifies love. I think one of the reasons that sanctifies it, and that's what makes it precious, is that you can't control it. You can't control another human. You don't know how someone is going to behave. And there's a risk when you love someone, not just that they're going to end up being like Max and Ghosts, but, you know, there's a risk that they're going to die or disappear or get very ill or something terrible happen to them. So that's part of the package deal of love, I think, is that there is no sat nav, really. You can just make as measured choices as you can make and love yourself and protect yourself as much as you can, but there's always going to be a risk.
There's a theory in the book that I really love, and that maybe explains the way that we are wired as women, and it's called the nothing like a cold beer gene. could you please elaborate that?
Yeah, sure. So Nina is someone who's quite cutting, and she's not hugely preoccupied with how others think of her. She's not a people pleaser. And I chose to write a character like that because I'm a huge people pleaser. So I wanted to know what it was like to be in the mind of someone who can kind of just say what they think and not be hugely destabilized by the opinions of others. Her best friend, on the other hand, is a girl called Lola, who I'm much more similar to. And Lola is someone who wants to please everyone and wants to always make the mood as light and buoyant and convivial as possible. She wants everyone to feel comfortable. And Nina watches Lola just make small talk with another woman who she doesn't get on with that well. And she kind of is in awe of Lola's ability just to fill the room with babble to make everyone feel comfortable and to accommodate everyone. And she said, you know, I wonder if Lola says, oh, there's nothing like a cold beer, just a meaningless phrase just to kind of keep things moving conversationally, which Nina finds, you know, Nina's very cynical and she finds that sort of empty chat kind of annoying. And she says, how is it that Lola knows how to say these phrases? Is it that this is in our DNA as women, that we have always been the ones who host and the ones who are put in charge of like managing the emotions and the atmosphere of a room? So we, you know, most of us have the ability to turn on charm and keep people happy even against our better will. Something that I read a few years ago that I found very interesting is in Viv Albertine's second memoir, I read that she said that they've recently found that autism is hugely undiagnosed in women. And one of the reasons they think that is because women are so socialized to code read and to make people feel comfortable and to mimic, you know, their mothers or women around them who kind of will say or do anything to keep everyone happy, that it almost makes, it conceals something as potentially debilitating as autism. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, so this whole theory that women are more like caring and taking care of people, that is like inbred in our DNA, is total bollocks. It's just...
I know.
Education.
Yeah. It's education, it's socialization, and it's the fact if we didn't in the homes, historically, no one else would.
Dolly, you were talking before about the children and the baby question, and apparently because of your book, I don't really know, because I'm 43 and I dated like ages ago, so I'm not really into my 30s, but apparently it does happen now when you are dating at your 30s, and it's the big questions in a relationship. People do actually ask, do you want to have children?
Yes, I mean, I do. I don't think it's as... I don't think that it's as commonplace as it should be. You know, there is a fact of life, which is that women have a window where they can have children. I don't think that the window is as small as we're often told it is. I don't think that the science that's quoted is often relevant or recent science. I don't think that you can generalize this window, because obviously there are so many factors that mean that women can have baby, you know, struggle to have babies as young, healthy women, or have babies very easily as women at the very end of that window. So I'm very careful when I talk about this stuff, but generally there is a window. And I think to dismiss that or pretend that doesn't exist can be very disempowering for women. And there are lots of women for whom they're not sure whether they want kids or they absolutely don't want kids, in which case that conversation isn't as pressing or doesn't need to be had at all when you start dating in your, you know, mid-30s. But for other women, that is something they really want to do as part of this journey around the sun. And I obviously think that that's a very natural inclination, a very human inclination. And I don't think that it should ever be denied to a woman on the grounds of not wanting to seem like a chill, fun lady at the beginning of a relationship.
Yeah, one of the characters says in the book, and I found it very interesting, she says, I know that clever women are meant to worry about having a family, and I know I still have time, but I'm scared that if I don't play for it, I will never happen. How many women do feel like that, Dolly?
I mean, nearly every woman I know. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know why it's, we don't really talk about it. I think maybe we worry that it, here's the thing. I think because when in your 30s, you're aware of there being a time limit for something for the first time in your entire life, I think there is just a period, particularly if you're single and you don't know how it's going to happen and you've had a difficult time in love, there is a time where it just completely obsesses, it can completely obsess you. And the reason why you don't talk about it with people is because it's only the time limit that make, and the fact that it's such a fatalist decision that you get to a point and then you can't do it in a certain way anymore. There are obviously lots of other ways in which you can do it, but you can't do it in the way that you probably imagined you were going to do it when you were a little girl and when you've grown up. So the problem is, it's not that having a baby or having a family is the most important thing for those women. And it's not that not having it would mean that they would be miserable. And it doesn't mean that it's more important to them than their career and their careers and their friendships and their interests. And it's not that they think that it will give them a happy ending. It's just that we've got a window of time. So the worry, I think, about giving that oxygen is that it's misleading and it makes you seem like you're obsessed with babies when you're not. You just don't want to forget to do it.
Mm. I don't know in the UK, but I don't think in Spain, or at least because I've got this podcast and we talk about lots of female health, women's health. I don't really know if we are that aware of fertility issues, or that we are really aware that when we turn 35, your ovaries just, they don't produce as many eggs as they used to. I don't really think that we are that aware, that we are not having that honest conversation about fertility.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because in a way, like, as you said that, as much as I do think it's kind of disempowering for women to not have information about their own bodies, which historically is like what has happened to keep us as disempowered as possible, like for us to not understand our own biology, I think you saying that, I did think, God, it would be nice to not have that information. It's a really delicate thing, because the other thing is, I think, is that too much of an awareness about biology and too much of a fear that of how time is tracking in your 30s is equally disempowering. Because then what it does is it makes women feel like they have no hand in their own fate unless they have the resources and money and extra help and maternity leave to do it on their own with a sperm donor or to adopt. It makes them feel like the hand, like the all their power is put in the hands of every man that they meet on a dating app. And that is really disempowering. And it's horrible to live your life like that, to basically feel like any time that you meet a romantic partner, they're the ones who are going to decide whether you have a family or not. Mm. It's so shit. Mm. So I don't know. It's a really difficult balance to strike. I mean, really what I think has to happen, I mean, I know nothing about the fertility industry and I know nothing about fertility medicine. Well, I know a bit with my friends who've gone through it. But from what I've gathered reading around this topic, I think really there needs to be much more money focused on helping women bank a bit more choice and time, but egg freezing, basically. I think that the government, I think that should be more of a collective responsibility, particularly if we want women to be focused and thrive in the workplace during this period of their life. Like, something's got to give. Mm-hmm. And something that I read that I think is interesting is, I think it's 80% of women who freeze their eggs don't go on to use those eggs and try to fertilize them into embryos. And again, this is just my speculation. I might be talking out of my arse, but I wonder if actually, because lots of my friends have frozen their eggs and they've said that it completely frees them up. Really, it doesn't free you up that much because it's still a very risky process, freezing eggs in terms of percentages, and they're not embryos. So you still have to, it's basically like the first round of IVF. Like, it's not like you freeze the eggs and then you go to the freezer 10 years later and there's like a little baby waiting for you that you take off the shelf. Like, it's a totally, it's like still quite risky. So it's interesting that like level of percentage, leverage of like maybe you'll be 20% more likely to have a baby, whatever, is the thing that potentially frees women up so they don't end up having to use them. And my theory is that once you stop being tyrannized by these stats and that number, the 35 thing in your head, that maybe once you know that you've got that security of the egg, you can just live your life and be yourself and choose the right partner. And that's why things normally happen organically anyway. I don't know. That's just my theory. I obviously think about this stuff a lot at the moment.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
¿Sabías que los bebés son capaces de autorregularse y comer lo que necesitan? Hasta el primer año, la leche ha de ser su alimento principal, bien sea lactancia materna o artificial, y poco a poco podrán ir probando diferentes texturas y alimentos. Ahora, con buena temperatura, a todos nos gusta salir más de casa, y en verano pasamos mucho tiempo fuera, en la playa, la montaña o recorriendo el mundo. Si tienes un bebé que ya ha empezado con la alimentación complementaria, para esos momentos puedes contar con los diferentes tarritos que ofrece Potitos. Hay recetas para bebés desde 4 y 6 meses y solo llevan ingredientes como frutas, verduras, carnes o pescados que se trituran y se envasan tal cual. Los Potitos de Nutriben son tarritos seguros, fáciles de conservar y transportar, ya que no necesitan refrigeración, tan solo mantenerse en un lugar fresco. Se calientan en microondas o al baño María, sin conservantes ni azúcares añadidos. Gracias a Nutriben y a su marca Potitos por ser nuestro mecenas del mes.
But maybe we should also talk that not having children is also an option. You know,
yeah,
we are planning
totally.
Yeah. There are so many women out there. I don't have children and I've talked about it on my podcast. And we are like sort of like invisible. We don't even have a word for women that don't have children. You are a mother or you don't have children, but there's no word to define what we are. We are not defined by that fact, you see? I think we should have more voices and more options, and not having children is also an option.
I totally agree. And the problem is when you hear about women not having children, it's nearly always through the framework of regret. But I know so many women who didn't have children and it was the best decision of their lives. And I must say, like, whenever I'm talking about this anxiety that of women in their 30s, in my pieces or when I'm interviewing, I do want to make it really clear. Like, I know that this is not something that is on the minds of lots of women. And frankly, I'm really fucking jealous of them. Like, I would do anything. I would empty my bank account, Christina, to wake up tomorrow morning and know that I absolutely didn't want kids. It would be freedom to me. I wish that I had that knowledge that I didn't want them. And I think, and I agree with you, as difficult as it is to be, you know, hounded by the question of when to have kids and how to have kids in your 30s, it's way more difficult, I think, to have to like deal with the general societal dismissal and sometimes stigma that comes with being a woman who doesn't have kids. It makes me so angry, the fact that we just don't seem to take the lives of childless women, even that phrase, childless women, like why should women be only contextualized with the concept of their fertility? But it makes me so angry that I don't think we culturally take their lives as seriously as women who choose to have families.
Yes, because we are asked the question, but they are never asked the same question, you know. Yeah. If I'm with my partner, it's always like, do you have children? But they direct a question to me, not to him. Do you have children yourself, you see? So I just think we need to have that conversation and talk openly about it. Because whenever you say, no, I don't have children, there's always like a question pending, like, she can't have children. She didn't want to have children. It's like, why? There's always like a second question. She doesn't have children, that's it.
Yeah. I know. And there's also, I've always found it sad that the celebrities who don't have children, like Jennifer Aniston or Kim Cattrall, when I've listened to interviews with them about it, they always seem like they have to prove that they are maternal in another way. So I've heard Kim Cattrall in an interview say, well, you know, I really look after the young women who work in my production company and they're like my daughters. Or I've heard Jennifer Aniston say, I've got lots of godchildren, lots of nieces, and they're like my children. And it's like, no one is asking men how they are fulfilling some sort of paternal responsibility that you have for being a human, that you have to somehow like care for little people. You can be a hugely compassionate, loving person. So arguably, some would say you might be more compassionate and loving because you're being very thoughtful about not bringing other people into the planet in a world that's burning down, and not have to prove in any sense that you have some sort of parental inclination. It drives me absolutely mental. I don't know how you don't kick them all when they ask you that question.
I always say, no, I don't have children, I've got a dog. And so the question. And they're like, oh, okay, next. Dolly, until I read your book, I didn't have any idea about this ghosting phenomenon. And for those who, like me, don't know what ghosting is, apparently it's when a person just stops speaking to you instead of having a breakup conversation. And Lola, again, she's brilliant. She has a theory in the book, and I wonder if you share it. She says that men of our generation often disappear once they've got a woman to say, I love you, back to them, because it's almost like they have completed a game, because they are the first boys who grew up glued to their PlayStations and Game Boys. Is that right?
I don't know. Lola's got a lot of mad theories. I definitely think that there's a correlation with ghosting between often on the more extreme end of ghosting, between men feeling like they've got to a certain level, which proves that they've managed to make a woman attached to them. And at that point, their ego is satisfied, the story is complete, they can exit the game and start a new game. At my most cynical, yes, I do believe that might be in the psychology of millennial men.
Dolly, Esther Perel, who has been a guest on this podcast.
I love her.
We did.
I bet she spoke Spanish. She speaks like 300 languages,
no,
doesn't she?
We did it in English because I read the book in English, so I wasn't sure if. And I said, no, let's do it in English just in case. But yeah, she's fluent. She's very fluent. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Impressive.
She's so clever. How can she be that clever and that hot? It's so annoying. I love her.
Yeah. And she's very, very well articulated. Yeah, it was brilliant It was brilliant to talk to her. So she said that never before have our expectations of marriage taken on such an epic proportions. We still want everything the traditional family was meant to provide, but now we also want our partner to love us, to desire us, to be interested in us. We should be best friends, trusted confidants, and passionate lovers. Do you think we have the wrong expectations?
Yeah, totally. I think heterosexuals are in a mess. I think we completely... I think it's all... Not to put too fine a point on it, I think it's all really fucked up. I think I constantly am looking at my friends who are queer and you know, living life in a less traditional way, in a less heteronormative way. And I think, God, that we could definitely learn. We could definitely learn from you guys. Totally. I mean, there's a double whammy for me because, yes, there is such a huge burden on the structure of marriage to uphold this domestic function and this function, you know, a function for raising citizens and that is like, you know, a sort of business function, really, is the marital home, as it always has been, I suppose, to also now satisfy our existential whims and our questions of identity and our sexual appetite and, you know, the idea of like soulful connection and spiritual connection and intellectual connection while also upholding a family. Yeah, it's a lot. And doing it while all trying to be monogamous, while now we live until we're like fucking 100 years old. So monogamy in the 1600s seemed like, I imagine, so much more of a manageable thing because we all died at 40. So we were only married for like 10 years or whatever. But now, you know, if you marry someone at 25 and you die at 100, come on, that's a lot. That's a lot to look at. I mean, I couldn't do that. So I think the pressure of monogamy in relation to how much longer we're living, and I do think is an issue. But the double whammy that I have is not only is like the cultural expectation of marriage now so enormous, is that I grew up in a house where that marriage existed. So I have this huge personal expectation of marriage that I think has completely messed me and my brother up colossally.
We can always blame the parents.
I know. It's hard, you know, when I hear someone really smart like Esther Perel or lots of psychologists or people I know who are married just being like, you know, your partner can't be your best friend and your greatest lover and an amazing co-parent. I'm like, well, they were in my house. Like, they can. I know it's very rare, but I can't. And they, you know, my parents had their issues, but like on the whole, they just had like a really great time together and a lot of fun. So, yeah.
Tough. Dolly, you write, I love this. You say, love is being the guardian of another person's solitude. Maybe friendship is being the guardian of another person's hope. Dolly, I would love to talk about female friendship. That's something that is that you have covered on both of your books and that really moved me. Why is it so important?
I think, sorry for that noise of that alarm in the background. That's it. Sonic, the symphonies of Camden on a Tuesday morning. I think first and foremost, I think it is just like the most fascinating and intense love that I have known personally. So when I wrote Ghosts, I wanted to write about men and women. And because my main touchstone for long-term, like really intense and long-term love, like my best friend now, we've been in each other's lives very, very close for 22 years. Because that is like the main long-term love that I've known, I can't help but write about female friendship and it's how it, you know, fluctuates and its complications and its joy and its mess. It's just the love that I understand the best and I have the most knowledge of. You know, I get lots of people in my Agony Aunt column asking me for advice on long-term marriages and long-term relationships. And I always do feel like saying, you know, this isn't really my arena. Like it's very easy for me to speculate on what a 20-year relationship is and give judgment and give my opinion. And indeed I do, not just with everyone who writes into my column, but basically any couple I ever meet at a party or any couple in my friendship group. Like I'm very interested in other people's relationships. But the longest relationship I've been in is 2 years. And that was, you know, I broke up with that man nearly a decade ago. So it's just the one place where I feel like I have absolute rock solid experience and knowledge. So yeah, that's the reason why I always return to it. And also, put simply, I just don't really see it explored in literature and in art and culture that often. You know, female friendship is either seen in the context of a thing that you do with someone while you're waiting for romantic love to come in your life, the place where you kill the relationship, where you kill time, or in the context of like a horror film where girls get too intense with each other and they cast spells or they knife each other in the back or whatever. So, you know, that just like looking at friendship through a romantic comedy lens of the silliness and the sadness and the sometimes tragedy and the highs and lows. And that I think people always like to see that reflected because it's not really given much airtime.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love the most about your writing. When you write about your friends and your relationship, it's great. It's great to see it. Dolly, your first book was a memoir of your 20s, and Nina, the main character of your new book, is over 30. There's always like a big debate on aging, especially for women. And I would love to bring the subject of agelessness, still in the words of Zadie Smith. She writes,
"Yeah.
When I think of each woman's particular contours and colors and way of burning, the idea of trying to make that light burn persistently at exactly the same wattage and intensity over decades seems to me a terrifying task to set oneself. Not unlike lighting a candle and expecting no wax to ever melt. We melt, and finally we're extinguished. How do you feel about it?"
Yeah, I mean, she's obviously a genius, and I love that passage. I think that the brightness of youth, the vitality of youth, the intensity of that kind of spiritual energy, and not least to mention the pressure to look 25 when you're 55. I think it does weigh. It weighs heavy on women. Aging is something that's always on my mind. I, you know, in the end, in everything I know about love, I ended up writing an extra chapter about turning 30 because I'm loath to say it, but I found turning 30 very difficult. And then obviously in Ghosts, there's a lot about aging and fading. And yeah, it's something that's on my mind a lot. Interestingly, I'm very preoccupied with death. I think about death about 60% of the day. And I've always been like that since I was a little girl. I've always found it quite difficult to go to sleep. And I think it's because, you know, sleep is the brother of death. And I don't want to get anywhere near it. I don't want anything to do with it. No, thank you. I want to be alive forever. I'm completely addicted to being alive. And I think that I hear Zadie Smith speaking a lot about death and time and having when time is running out, how much time she's been through, how she's making the most of her time now. And I think, I mean, that's where the parallels between Zadie Smith and I end, sadly, because I'd love to be more like Zadie Smith. But I think, I do think it's a writer's, I do think a lot of writers are very preoccupied with the notion of age and time. And I also think, I remember hearing Zadie Smith say she had a much older dad, and I did as well, not as old as Zadie Smith's dad. Zadie Smith was much, much older. But my dad was in his mid-40s when he had me in the late 80s, which at the time was quite old. And I think, you know, I remember when I was very, very little, I had people mistake my dad for my grandfather. So it means from a really, really, really young age, my tiny little brain was completely submerged in this notion of age and time. And I think as I got into my teens, I became very obsessed with the idea of age and time, for how different that is for women, and youth as a commodity for women against men. So yeah, it's always going to be on my mind.
No answer yet for that one.
No.
I've got the same problem as Sadie Smith. I'm turning 44, and sometimes I'm like, how on earth? I'm not 44. My age doesn't represent me. I'm full of vitality, you know. And the fact is that I mean, live half of my life.
40s is the decade, apparently. That's what my mum and dad say. They say it's the best decade that you can live in. But I do think as well, like, you know, when you have those friendships where you look that you've known the girls since you were like a teenager and you look at them and you're like, you still look exactly the same. I do think that something weird goes on in our brains to help us, you know, to help us cope, where I truly, when I look in the mirror, I can't see a difference between, everyone's got an age in their head that they're fixed on. I think mine's 17. What's yours?
I think like around 25.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you'll be 25 forever.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Dolly, in I Feel Bad About My Neck, a book that we both love by Nora Ephron, she writes, I can make a case that I regret nothing. After all, most of my mistakes turn out to be things I survive or turn into funny stories or on occasion even made money from it. But the truth is that je regret beaucoup. Do you have any regrets?
Loads. I hate people who say they don't have any regrets. It's the thing that makes me most suspicious of a human when they tell me they have no regrets. I almost immediately know that I will never be close with them. I just think every day is about making lots of choices. And I say I probably get about half of them right, whether it's what sandwich to pick up in Pret or how to speak to a colleague or... No, I'm completely full of regrets. I think regret is a really important part of being a human.
Do you regret the things you've shared? Because all the things you shared were very personal in your books, in your Instagram, the podcast.
It's a really interesting question. So I'm now very, very private. I don't talk about my personal life and my work. I barely, you know, I use Twitter just for work. I barely share anything on Instagram that isn't work related. And I would be amazed if I ever wrote nonfiction again. So for me now, as a 32-year-old with my 32-year-old brain, am I embarrassed of all the stuff that I shared in my 20s? Yes, I'm mortified. It doesn't feel like me and it feels like a completely different person. However, if I were to go back in a time machine and say to that 25-year-old, don't write this, don't share that, don't open up your life like that, I know what she would have said, which is, fuck off. This is what I want to do right now. You deal with your own stuff in your decade on your time, girlfriend. You deal with that when you're 32, but don't bring your shame to me because this is exactly what I want to do. So that's what I have to constantly remember. I'm always in conversation with my younger self because I might be putting my own head on her now and thinking, you know, oh, she felt like she had to write that stuff or she was really insecure and she needed lots of attention. But that's just not true. I was just a blabbermouth and I loved sharing and I loved being outrageous and I loved opening up all my mistakes to, you know, feel like I'm connecting to lots of other readers. And that's exactly what I did. So I need to really watch myself with that, with the notion of regret with that one.
Yeah, and this is something that you do just to protect yourself, not to suffer or not to be charged? Or why have you changed?
I think people get more private naturally as they get older. I think that a sense of who they are and connection with others can be achieved without personal information. I've simply just got lots more people interested in what I do now. You know, when I was really, really sharing a lot, like that dating column when I was 26, I had like 300 Instagram followers. I had, you know, 1,000 Twitter followers. I just didn't have people really listening to me or reading me or, you know, looking at what I was doing other than my extended friendship group. And they weren't really interested in deducing who I am or making a judgment on who I am or who my family are or who my past part or potential partners are. So now I just understand. I'm not resentful about it. I've opened up my life and shared everything. So of course, some people want to know, and they want to make a judgment or connect the dots, so they have a satisfying narrative about where I am in my life right now. I completely understand why they want to do it. I just don't want to partake in that. I don't have the inclination or the desire to be known like that anymore, for that to be the cost. And I'm not built for it. I'm too sensitive. I can't. I would prefer to, and it's hard because my inclination is still sometimes to want to share, and I have to stop myself because I can't. I'm never going to be someone with a thick enough skin that when I see people make assumptions about me or the people that I love, that's going to not affect me. It will really affect me. So the best way that I can do it, that I can avoid that, is to just not enter into it.
Dolly, I'm about to finish, but before we leave, I always take notes of the books and the podcasts that you recommend. So it's mandatory to ask you, what are you listening to and what are you reading at the moment?
Great question. So for some reason, this lockdown in London, we're in like a 6-month lockdown at the moment. We're nearly at the end. But it's been a long one. We've been in lockdown since November. It's now spring. And this lockdown, for some reason, I found it really hard to concentrate on books. You know, I normally read like a book a week, and I found it really difficult to read. I've managed to read one over the last couple of months that was so beautiful. It's called Little Weirds by Jenny Slate, who's an American comedian. And it just completely electrified me. She's got a really kind of zany, interesting way of looking at the world. And she's also just really, really funny. And it's short chapters. They're kind of like little vignettes. And it's a lot about being a woman in your 30s. And it's a lot about heartbreak. If anyone's going through heartbreak, she ascribes extraordinary metaphor and imagery to the process of what it is to have your heart fucking ripped to pieces. So I loved that. I'm sorry for swearing so much in this episode. I hope you don't have to bleep lots out.
I said bollocks, so.
Okay, we're fine. And then podcast-wise, what am I loving? I mean, that, to be honest, I'm now, because I listen to so many podcasts, I now feel like I've just got my best mates, which is like 10 podcasts I listen to, and I listen to them every week. And I'm kind of like, I might have some new friends come in, but really it's just those 10. Like, they're the only ones I really want to listen to anymore. So Fortunately is one of my big ones. Have you heard of that podcast?
No.
If you're ever missing London, Christina.
Okay.
Why would you when you live somewhere so hot? If you're ever missing English people, Fortunately is a really charming, really funny, very British podcast with two women called Fee Glover and Jane Garvey.
Jane Garvey,
50s,
yeah, BBC, Women's Hour,
yes.
Of
yeah,
course,
yeah,
yeah, Radio 4, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So when she does Women's Hour, she's obviously quite serious, but she's a brilliant journalist. But there's this like podcast that she does that's just her being so funny and silly with her friend Fee. And it's just like two women at a stage in their life where they've just like, they just don't give a shit anymore. And it's just an absolute joy to listen to.
Oh, that's great. And we do miss Desert Island Disc with... Do you miss it?
With Kirsty. Yeah, I think Lauren's doing a really good job. And I think that there's always like a, you know, habituation period with new presenters, obviously, because Kirsty did it for so long. But yeah, I do miss that. I do miss that Scottish voice. I just got so used to it.
Me too. And I miss you too. So, Dolly, let's just have a quick look at your crystal ball and tell me.
Okay.
What do you see in the future?
Oh, okay. What do I see? How far in the future?
Let's put like 5 years' time.
5 years. Okay. I would have made a TV show. I would have had a TV show on television. I would have written another novel. I would have moved to a new neighborhood. with a slightly bigger kitchen in my flat, I would have traveled much more. Obviously, the last year has just made me absolutely desperate to travel. And then I would probably, I probably would have, this is all so optimistic, written a romantic comedy, written a feature, romantic comedy feature film. And then, to be totally honest, I would hope that I had met someone that I loved and that I was falling in love or that I was in love with someone and maybe living together. I've never lived with a man, so I'd like to do that. So that's what I hope for.
We take note in 5 years' time. 5 years' time, we talk.
Let's do it.
Dolly Alderton, I only have one more thing to say in a very George Michael style.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I love that song so much.
Oh, what a treat to talk to you. Honestly, you made my day. You made the whole season. So thank you, Dolly Alderton. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Christina, I've loved it. Thank you for your thoughtful questions and for being so lovely.
Thank you so much. What a nice way to enjoy the podcast. And I can't even say anything which makes sense right now. I wish I was there to give you like a big hug. So
I know, me too. I enjoyed that chat so much. Thank you so much for such thoughtful questions.
And I know that you've got so many fans in Spain because I've told them, I'm going to interview Dolly and they're like, oh my God, is she coming back to the high low? So... I was like, I don't know.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much.
So thank you, Dolly. And thanks for your writing and thanks for your podcast and thanks for the good memories that I've shared with your boys. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, my darling. Well, if I'm ever in Dubai, I'll hit you up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And definitely if I'm in London, I will drop you a message. So thank you, Dolly. What a pleasure. Lots of love.
Don't forget that all the notes for this episode are in my blog, thebeautymail.es. Also, if you don't want to miss an interview, subscribe to the Christina Mitre podcast on your regular podcast app. And one last favor. If you listen to me on Apple Podcasts, give me a few stars and leave a review. That way, you will help this podcast to continue growing. Thank you very much. You will be hearing from me again next Sunday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.